Good afternoon and happy Sabbath, everyone. I know you all recognize that hymn. It's in our hymnal. It's one of the most famous hymns in the world. I consider it bulletproof. I had a piano teacher who used to refer to pieces that way. He would say, oh yeah, Clair de Lune. He said, that's bulletproof. No one can ruin it, even though many have tried. And that hymn is so well known around the world in all Christian communities. It was written by a man named Isaac Watts in the late 1700s. It hasn't always been in our hymnal, but I think since the first hymnal after the old purple Worldwide Church of God hymnal, it's had a place in our hymnals. And it's a hymn of strength and about God's eternity and man's frailty by comparison. When it was put in our current hymnal, I lobbied strong and hard to have a fifth verse added. There's nine actual verses to it, and thankfully the editors didn't put in all nine. But there's a reason there's nine verses. But the verse that they left out is, to me, one of the most poignant and poetic ones. Of course, the first one that you just heard is, O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the stormy blast, and our eternal home. But the verse that I wish we had in our hymnal is, time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. They fly forgotten as a dream, dies at the opening day. And it's just a poignant addition, and it's scriptural. And I think, among other things, it's a very good song for a memorial service. We had it at my father's memorial service, because that verse reminds us that we are all here for a short time, especially compared to God's eternity. But they didn't want a fifth verse in. They thought it was too many words at that point, which I understand. And of course, it wasn't written by a church person, so there was no one to lobby for the fifth verse, and the seventh verse, and the eighth verse, and the ninth verse. But you know what? This hymn was written by a church person. This hymn is the only hymn that we have that's based on Psalm 90. And I don't know if Psalm 90 rings any bells to you, but it was written by a church person. We don't know his last name. His first name was Moses. You know, I can't stand the movie The Ten Commandments. I just don't like it. I know people love it, but one of the things I hate is when that princess, every time she sees Charlton Heston, she says, oh, Moses, Moses. And it's never just, so maybe that was his last name too. I don't know. Moses, Moses. And it drives me crazy. I don't like it. And then I was reading the part in the burning bush, and God out of the burning bush says, Moses, Moses. So I guess the princess was scripturally right on, and I wasn't. But I was contemplating this psalm a few weeks ago. I actually, just by coincidence, happened to be, I had just spent a week at camp, and I was lolling in luxury on a beautiful cabin that a friend of mine, one of my longest friends, I've known him longer than any of you, including Taya, and his wife had built on a mountaintop in Idaho. And the mountain, I realized while I was reading this, is called Moses Mountain. So there I was. Moses, who wrote the psalm, had never actually been there, as far as I know. But it's Psalm 90, and it's a prayer of Moses. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion on, is the authorship valid for any book of the Bible? And you just sort of have to accept it, that this was written by Moses. The arguments, pro and con, as to whether it was written by Moses, really don't have to do with anything scholarly. I mean, from some of the earliest versions of Jewish scriptures, this is designated as a prayer of Moses. But it has to do with the actual words that were spoken, and would Moses have actually said those things? And we'll look at those things a little bit. But the fact remains that this is a psalm that was written by our brother and predecessor, Moses. And he, you know, what was, is a church member. God is God of the living. And what that means is that he was the first psalm writer. This is the oldest psalm that we know of. We don't know how old some of the other psalms are, but this is the oldest one that we know of. And so he was the first hymn writer. And one of the crimes I commit is that I read about God's friends in the Bible, and Moses was definitely a friend. He's not called that. He's called a man of God, and he's praised in many other ways. But I read them, and I base my concept of them on the few things that we know about them from scriptures, not the fact that this was a man whom God called to do a mighty work, and that when Jesus Christ in his own ministry was starting to languish and feeling a bit down about the things that lay ahead of him, God caused a meeting, a vision to take place where Moses and Elijah appeared to Jesus Christ, and it said that they encouraged him. They talked about the things that were going to come. So this was someone who was tied to God by the heartstrings. This was someone whom God knew well. And it's surprising when I read about Moses in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and other things, he comes off as a bit of a stuffed shirt. And I say things like that knowing that someday Moses will know I said that. And I truly don't mean it, because, as I said, I tend to judge people by the way they come off in the few things that we know about them. And Moses, you know, he's was there ever a person who was more of a legalist than Moses? He brought down the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai. He gave us the law. And when we say Moses, it's a catch-all phrase, and people sometimes know that we mean the law. But Moses was also a person who was very close to God. God said, you know, have I appeared face to face with anyone else? This is a person who had great depths, and there was much more to him than just those words. He didn't seem to have a sense of humor much in the Bible, and I think, well, if I was trying to find someone to go to supper with, it probably wouldn't be Moses. I mean, it would be awkward, you know, Mr. Legal and all that stuff. But from this psalm, I think I'm wrong, and I'm probably wrong about most of the people with whom God has developed strong friendships over eternity. And these people still mean something to him. He said, you know, in the very last verses of the Old Testament, remember the law of Moses, and Elijah will come. And those are the two names that keep cropping up. So Moses is still very much in God's mind. So let's look at this psalm, Psalm 90. We will just stay there. I don't even have a Bible with me. I have a piece of paper with Psalm 90 printed out. Because I don't own a New King James Bible, and I wanted to read from the New King James translation. The church has always, the United Church of God has defaulted to New King James. You're allowed to read and use whatever scriptures you want. But I've tended to be more of a New International person, but I'm coming to appreciate, ironically, that New King James has a lot going for it, in that the translators don't try to gussy up things or change things. They try to present things the way the scriptures present them, and I value that more and more. So let's look at Psalm 90. Psalm 90, verse 1, the words of Moses. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations, and sometimes it's translated as a refuge. The original Hebrew is a dwelling place, which is interesting because we don't really dwell in God. This is poetry. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth, and again, in the original Hebrew, the writer of these words was very poetic. He basically said, you gave birth to the earth and the world. And of course, that's not literally true. They were made, but at the same time, this is a poet speaking to us. Even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You are God. And so he's establishing, O God, our help in ages past. He's establishing that God is forever and was there forever, farther back than that we could ever go. And verse 2 is as far back as we can go before the earth was made. We just don't know much about that. Verse 3, you turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past and like a watch in the night. And this is the verse that Peter quotes in his second letter when he says 1,000 years are like a day to God. He's riffing on this verse. You carry them away like a flood. They are like a sleep in the morning. They are like grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and withers. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. So this is a time of trouble for the poet. For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and in the and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, in the King James Version, this is 70 and 80, and often gets quoted that way. And Abraham Lincoln supposedly was influenced by that when he started out the Gettysburg Address. Yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. And by number, he doesn't mean just count them. He means that we should look at each day individually and treasure it and see how we can live God's way. Return, O Lord, how long, and have compassion on your servants. O satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. And those last two verses are one of the reasons that I'm in the New King James, because I like the way that they present those words. Now, we read this and people try to fit it in with the story of Moses from the time of the children of Israel leaving Egypt and him leading them and all the events that happened. And yet it doesn't really fit with that. And that's a bit of a mystery, and that's why people say, well, how could this be Moses? It doesn't work. One of the things is in verse 13 where he says, return, O Lord, how long? Well, not only had the Lord returned by then, but Moses, by the second year of what we call the Exodus, knew that it was going to be 40 years. He didn't have to ask how long. God told him more than once that it would be 40 years. And then, of course, the other verses in verse 10, the days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength, they are 80 years. And that's a bit of a problem, because Moses lived to be 120. He died a young man. His father was 137. His uncle, I think, lived to be 140. So it would be a very unusual age for any of us, but it wasn't so much for Moses. And here he is saying that the days of our lives are 70 years, and maybe, you know, we're strong, they're 80 years. How many here are over 70? According to this psalm, you're on borrowed time. No charge for the information. But Moses, of course, when he led the children out of Israel, he was over 80 and well over 80 by the time that he actually died. And so this sounds a little strange. And I ask you, and I'm not the first person to think of this, what if this was written at a different time in Moses' life? And probably, of course, it wouldn't have been the first 40 years of his life when he was a prince of Egypt, because he probably didn't spend a lot of time contemplating the mysteries of the world at that point. But it was after that his life had been turned upside down and he had to flee Egypt and he had a death sentence placed upon him, and that he found refuge as a shepherd for a man whose daughter he eventually married, and he had 40 years to think. And what if in those 40 years his thinking did him a lot of good? Let's look at it from that point of view and see if it seems to make sense. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. He knew that good things came from God at that point. And incidentally, his father-in-law, as you recall, was known to be a priest of Midian and helped Moses out in many times. And so the father-in-law was connected to Yahweh God. Well, he hadn't announced his name at that point, but the God of Israel. His father-in-law, he's called a priest of Midian. He wasn't a high priest of Israel, but he was in tune with God's way of life. So these were probably things that they talked about at the dinner table or at other times. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And so Moses had made peace with that. David tended sheep and wrote many songs, probably some of them while he was tending the sheep. And you have time to think. I mean, they lie down a lot. You have time when you watch sheep. Sometimes they could drive you crazy, I'm sure. But you turn man to destruction and say, "Return, O children of men." Well, that's true. God does let people experience the consequences of their own turning away from him, and he's always trying to get, I mean, that's the message today, isn't it? Return, O children of men. But this is something, you know, Moses had turned to destruction. And furthermore, he saw his people being severely overworked and severely punished and severely malnourished and treated very badly and whipped and killed. And that's what the children of Israel were going through at this point. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. You carry them away like a flood. They are like a sleep. In the morning they are grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and withers. And what had happened to God's family, God's magnificent royal Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Joseph family at this point? They were downtrodden slaves. They were nobodies. They were punished. And it says, "We have been consumed by your anger and by your wrath. We are terrified." And yes, that did happen after the children of Israel left Egypt. But at the same time, God was with them for those 40 years. And here's a man who is waiting for God to return to them. "You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance." And what he's saying is, you know, you know us very well, and this is not something we don't deserve. You're still working with us, because that was what God had to work with. He had already chosen the sons of Jacob at that point. And yet there they were, slaves in a foreign land. Verse 9, "For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away." And although people at that time could live longer, he was probably watching the children of Israel wither and die out like grass. They were tormented. Abused. They were harassed. It was a terrible time for them. And what good did years do at that point but just open you up to more of that kind of life? 11, "Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom." And this is an interesting point for Moses the shepherd to be at, because sometimes, you know, I read the story of the burning bush and Moses, and it seems like God is dealing with a damaged person, with maybe even a person, well, do we use the word handicap, challenge? I mean, Moses, he said, "I can't even talk." You know, he had to be corrected by God. God finally got angry with him when Moses was there. And so sometimes we look at Moses as not an idiot, but, you know, a subpar intellect dealing with God. And you think, why would God speak to this man out of a burning bush? But what if Moses, over those 40 years, had developed an intense, personal, poetic, beautiful relationship with God? And what if by the time he heard the voice out of the bush, that he was already a friend of God, and that in his own life, what had been purified, what needed to be, and what had been proven, and he was already at that point. It makes so much sense to me. And he says, "Return, O Lord, how long, and have compassion on your servants." And those would be the words of a person watching his people, whom he personally had overlorded as a prince and abused them in his own way just by being part of that family. These are people that he was watching be oppressed, and he's saying, "Return, O God." In the Exodus and further on, of course, God had already returned. And although there were problems, God's presence was very well known, and he was easy to find and easy to call on. But Moses is saying, "Have compassion on your servants. Oh, satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil." And of course, the children of Israel had fallen away from God at that point, not in every way. I mean, they were still known as children of God, but we know they really didn't know when the Sabbath was. They probably were heavily influenced by the gods and religions of Egypt at that point, and it was a terrible thing that the entirety of God's family at that point was in bondage. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. And then verses 16 and 17 I have memorized, and the reason I've memorized them is these are things that I say in my own prayers, but I didn't realize that they had been spoken almost 4,000 years ago and written down. Because these not only apply to a time when Moses is saying, you know, I am yours, I understand that you are eternal and that we are frail, but what is going on here? You've preserved us for something. What is happening? He was expecting something to happen at that point. And so he says in verse 16, let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children. He's saying, I don't know what you're going to do, but make it clear to me. Please let me understand what you're going to do. And I pray that prayer myself, and I bet some of you do too, because I've seen the church in its ups and its downs. And as a family, I love the church today, and I think we're doing wonderful. And I think we're doing everything we can to get the word of God preached and to reach the world. But even the most cheerleading observer has to say that we're not having that much of effect, at least not the way that we used to, and that God is in charge, and so this is the way that he wants it to be. But I keep thinking that another work has to come. And, you know, I mean, if I'd arise out of an organization that currently exists, I can't say. But what I do pray to God is when it happens, let me see it and let me know that it's your work. And the way he phrases it, let your work appear to your servants, he wants something to happen, and your glory to their children. So he wants that to be restored to the people of Israel, to even the children, so that even the children would shout and rejoice when God finally rises up and does what he's going to do. And in verse 17, this next line amazes me. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us. Because what kind of thing is that to pray? I mean, I do pray for beauty. I'm a big believer in beauty. And Isaiah talks about that part of the end time work will be giving people beauty instead of ashes. But the word beauty doesn't really come into our Church of God experience very much. That's a terrible thing to say as I'm staring at you. But I don't mean it that way. You're beautiful people, okay? But it's not something that we associate with God. We associate God with power and authority and rise up and conquer and, you know, or other things, save and redeem and things like that. But how much do we associate God with beauty? And Moses had spent 40 years contemplating it, and like David, he saw that God's way of life and God himself was a beautiful thing. And this is something that friends of God come to. This is a conclusion that friends of God come to, that they're no longer in it for the power and the authority and the office or things like that, and they're no longer in it just to obey the law. They're in it to experience all the positive things that God's love and goodwill brings to his people, and it comes out in beauty, whether it's his creation or his way of life or the way that people can be when they deal with each other on the highest and best terms. Let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us. So this was someone who had arrived at that, and he was a friend of God at this point, and established the work of our hands for us. What does that mean? Well, it sounds like he's saying, give me something to do. You know, I'm in a unique position. I was a prince of Israel. I'm your friend. I understand you. But he's saying, establish the work of our hands for us. And it's not enough to say it once. He says it twice. This is on his mind. Yes, establish the work of our hands. And that's similar to the prayer that I pray. Every day time that I pray, I say, let the beauty of the Lord be upon us. I don't say it that way, but I say, you know, come and restore all the good things that we've already experienced, but make it happen. Make the whole world as beautiful as it was when you created it. And please establish the work of your people. Let the work of your people no longer be in a drought, but let it be productive and let it be expansive and let it have an effect on the entire world. And so these verses 16 and 17 not only show the frame of mind that this shepherd had come to at this point, but they also apply so much, this psalm applies to our time right now, because we're also in a time where we're awaiting the power of God. We're waiting for him to rise up, and he won't literally bring people out of Egypt this time, but figuratively, yes, that will happen, that people will come out of that, and that he will rescue his people, and that, you know, before Jesus returns, the entire world will know that it's an option. The gospel will have been preached to everybody. And so this was not only important to a person, 3,700 years ago, but it's important in the year 2024, especially in the uncertainty that we face in our modern world. I hope none of you had flights scheduled this weekend. I was talking to a customer, you know, about the presidential election. I didn't bring the subject up, and we both agreed that there was nobody we really wanted to vote for, so why didn't we start a write-in campaign for Dolly Parton? And, you know, Dolly Parton's done a lot of things, and she's old enough to be president. I mean, she's as old enough as those guys. And, of course, we were laughing, but on the way home, I'm thinking, wait a minute. Maybe I'll vote for Dolly Parton this year. Who knows? You know, there'll be a write-in slot, and I can do that. But it's a world, you know, that we abide in. We're not shepherds, but we're biding our time, as Moses was at that point. And we say to God things like, let your work appear to your people, the people who know about it, and may your Holy Spirit make it clear that it is your work and so that I support it. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands for us. Please let us be a part of that. And this work that we're contributing to and trying so hard, make it effective. Only you can do that. So it's not only for now, but it also affected this shepherd all those years ago. And so, yes, God is from eternity to eternity. But I think I understand Moses a little better at this point. What am I saying? I understand him a lot better, that he was a man whose heart was stirred. He wasn't just a legalist who obeyed God and yelled at the children of Israel when they didn't. He was someone who was a friend of God, and this happened before he was 80 years old. And it changes everything in my mind for the big surprise that was coming to him. Because he thought, like us, that this kind of thing might go on forever. Sure, we say that things will change, but do we really believe it? Well, we do, and we await that. But Moses, you know, he had to complete the 40 years as a shepherd, and he had to complete his character growth to the point where he was ready to be surprised by a voice out of a burning bush that wasn't consumed and said, Moses, Moses, and after that, nothing was the same.